thought we might talk a little bit about karma. And this, of course, is coming from the Zen perspective. And so just bear with me that it's got a little different bent and sounds a little different. And some of the information. When I first came, we were studying the Book of Serenity on koans. I came from a business world background, and I was older, and I thought, well, they're speaking English, and I don't understand a word they're saying. But there was that little thread that just kept saying, you don't have to understand. Just listen. And it has served me well. And then another wonderful woman who was a guest student at Green Gulch Farm when I was, looked at me and said, you have to find your own way in. And I heard that. You have to find your own way in. You are only responsible. You are the one responsible for how you meet your interior life and how the way your mind works. And I think that all the causes and conditions, which is causality and what I'll talk about a little tonight, really speaks to that. Of what it is to be in this practice of Buddhism in America, as we're looking to investigate what it is. So I think most of you know that karma is one word, K-A-R-M-A, and then the Sanskrit, and then kama, as if you were coming from the East Coast, is the Pali word. But I'd like to just review some of the chief points for those of you who may be new or maybe... how many are here for the first few times or anybody new? Okay. So I'll just talk a little bit about... I have my nice notes so I stay on track, just so that you also know. So according to the Pali Canon, Buddha realized the cause and effects of karma on the night of his awakening. So that has to do with the remembrance of previous lives, his insight into death, and the rebirth of beings throughout the cosmos. So maybe another way of saying this is that he is said to have remembered all of his previous lives, which were governed by the general principles underlying the workings of the universe. One's life actions linked to the following life by way of passing along the seeds of those actions. All actions have consequences, is the summation of that. All of our actions have consequences, positive and negative and neutral. What was the central to his insight of the mind's, to one's mind, the role in determining the moral quality of one's action? That was another part of it. The moral quality of one's actions. For him, it was less the question of the physical act taking place as it was the mental qualities that played the larger role. Chief among those qualities is intention, that which constitutes the decision to act. So intention, in turn, is informed by how we perceive something along with the attention we bring to bear on it. Along with the attention we bring to bear on it. An important part of it. What is our attention for our intention? In short, how we deal with our present experience is informed and determined by our past experiences, which were largely governed by what intention moved our actions. Again, another repeat. There's an old saying that goes like this, and we wrote it wrong first, and then I remembered. Have an impulse, create a thought. Have a thought, create an act. Have an act, create a habit. Have a habit, create a destiny. The central point behind all of this is how can we live our lives free of our views and actions that lead us and others into suffering. And of course, that leads to the teachings of the Dharma, the Eightfold Path, the precepts, the Four Noble Truths, and on of these teachings, these basic teachings of all the Buddhist tenets. Another question is, how can we train our minds to see what right action is when we also know that our thoughts are really cultural, linguistic constructs? We make it up. And we make it up for all the causes and conditions that we've been raised on, that we've listened to. And now, probably since my generation, from television, we have a tremendous amount of input and reactions. Study ourselves as we will, practice as we will, still we cannot ultimately determine what the results of our actions may be by in this lifetime or in future lifetimes, if you subscribe to that thought of rebirthing and that way of karma. And the Buddha is said to have three kinds of karma: simply, good, bad, and mixed. The good are the teachings, the Eightfold Path, the precepts, just what I spoke of before. The bad, unwholesome action and intentions, greed, hate, and delusion. And the mixed, by the combination of all the various things, some good, some bad, out of our results. Most of these stories can be predicated by one or more of these. Here's a story I heard. I didn't write the stories, but I wanted to tell you three stories. This was great. Blanche Hartman said this story a long time ago, one of our former abbesses of San Francisco Zen Center. A young American male went for a holiday in Mexico. While there, he was approached by a person who sold him a couple of marijuana cigarettes. As soon as he paid the person, he was nabbed by the police and charged with possession of narcotics. When he was being led into jail, a guard said to him, "Señor, life jumps." We've all experienced in various ways at times in our life, teenagers, parents, children, life jumps. The unexpected just is in front of us. Just one day it's one thing, and the next day it's completely changed. So the mixed part of it is, even if the young man wanted to buy the marijuana for medical purposes, you could say to help alleviate the effects of a sick wife's chemo treatments, a compassionate intention, he still ended up in jail. Mixed karma. He had an intention. We have to look through and see that life jumps. Here's another example. Two men were close friends and both fell in love with the same woman, a classical triangle. The one man proposes marriage to the woman, but she calls the other man in secret, the friend of the first, and tells him she wants him to be her lover. He refuses in spite of his desire for her, out of his sense of respect and honor regarding his relationship to his friend. In other words, he thinks he's done the right thing, and most of us would agree. Later, his friend and the women do marry, but shortly thereafter, they are killed in a natural disaster. The man asks himself, "What if I hadn't refused her offer? They wouldn't have been married, and they would both be alive." Karma. Life jumps. So there's another great story of Deepak Chopra that says, and you may have heard this, he recorded it with Robert Thurman, and he says, a friend of Ronald Reagan was visiting the former president who was suffering from Alzheimer's. Reagan had just returned from a session with a therapist and was clutching a small plastic model of the White House, which someone had left on a table by the door. Nancy Reagan went up to him and tried to take it from his hand, but the president would not let it go. She asked him, "What is that, Ronnie?" He replied, "I don't know, but I think it has something to do with me." That's like karma. You don't know what it's about, but you feel it has something to do with you. It's like when we wake up from a powerful dream. We can't recall the dream, but it casts a spell over our day, our mood, our thoughts, and our actions. I think these examples point to one thing. No matter how hard we try to live our life according to our higher ideals and practices, we can never really know what the consequences will be. We can't control anything. We just have to meet what comes up in front of us moment by moment, day by day. And that does bring me the story. Many of you in this room might remember that the Carlos Castaneda story with his experience with the Yaqui sorcerer Don Juan. This is one of my favorites. He writes about how one day they were walking in the desert and Carlos stopped to tie a shoelace. Just then, ahead of them, a few paces, a huge boulder crashed down on the path. Castaneda exclaims, "Don Juan, if I hadn't stopped to tie my shoelace, we would have been crushed to death by that boulder." Don Juan replies, "True, but maybe next time you stop to tie your shoelace, the timing will place you exactly in that place where the boulder falls." Castaneda said he was swept with despair. He cried out, "Don Juan, what can one do?" And Don Juan replied, anybody remember? "One ties one's shoelace impeccably." "One ties one's shoelace impeccably." I put that up on the mirror in my room for a long time, as I was trying to just kind of find my way during a particularly difficult time. But I think this is what practicing our life means. Mindfulness, moment after moment, our actions may lead to our deaths or to something entirely unexpected, however good our intention. In fact, we all know the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Don't know. Don't know. And I think I'm only saying this because I think we too often practice from the point of view of doing the right or wholesome or good thing. But without the insight into the non-duality of all things, of the emptiness of phenomena, the interdependence and the mutual interconnectedness of actions, we will feel confused, lost, betrayed, when out of the blue, life jumps. And I think most of us have had that experience, know it, are familiar with it. And I think we have to remember that we don't practice the Dharma in order to congratulate ourselves for being on the right side. That's delusion, according to the Buddha. Thus have I heard. The Zen ancestor Dogen Zenji said, and this is another one that I keep up, "Those who have great realization about delusion are Buddha." Let me repeat that. "Those who have great realization about delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings." We have to remember, we just, everything we say is based on our delusion. Might be a nice delusion. We think if we work hard at our practice that a moment will dawn when all of our pain and troubles fall away, that we're going to get something. That my experience and that of most of those I know who have been practicing for a long time is not that they have become fundamentally transformed. It may be possible, but more common is the feeling that you become more and more aware, exquisitely aware, of the details and the texture of your suffering. And the suffering meaning the separation you have from yourself and others. That separation, where is that? That your suffering is the result of certain mind states, habits, patterns that have dug deep neural pathways into the brain, the deep neural pathways of our brains. In fact, you do become aware that desire of any kind is your adaptation to the illusion of a solid, permanent world. And it is a very impermanent world. And I think one of the things I've been practicing with, especially in the last couple of years, has been and it becomes deeper each year that I work with it, has to do with my unexamined assumptions. I thought I had raised my sons to be this. I thought I had taught. I thought I was going to be. I had a dream. I had an idea. And I had an expectation of those results. And this teaching, to the best of my, and it is a limited knowledge, is that we just have to meet our life as it comes forth with no expectations. Tomorrow someone may wake up, may go to the doctor, and they have breast cancer. Life jumps. And then you just meet breast cancer. Then you just meet prostate cancer. Then you just meet, you walk in to work, especially because these times are getting a little dicey again. They're getting a little dicey again. There's that little thing resting on your shoulder all the time. How's work going to be? Am I going to have my job? Am I going to be able to pay the bills? And you just watch what arises. It isn't that the anxiety and the fear isn't going to arise and the stories aren't going to arise. You just have to remember their stories. And yes, it may be hard to pay the bills. Those things are facts. But you're trying to work for that balance, that equanimity. How do you meet it? How do you pay attention? You take responsibilities for the choices you make. You step into them and you face them impeccably. I think at various times in our life, moment by moment, we have to meet this way that we are in this unbelievable place that we have with all of our problems impeccably. I had an opportunity, some friends took us to Bali, and then from Bali we went to Vietnam and to Cambodia. It was a life-changing experience for me. And for those of you in my age group that have anything to do with the experience of the Vietnam War, we were on the Mekong Delta River for 8 hours. And the husbands didn't go, just the wives went. And I grabbed my friend Mary Kay's hand and I said, Mary Kay, we are on the Mekong Delta. This was such a deep pain for many in this room also, as a young woman. The pain was so great in what we were doing, and we'd been out on the river for about 3 hours, and we went to this island called Unicorn Island. And we went up, and then we came back, and we came back in the very small, narrow areas where two rowboats were like this as they passed each other. And you knew this was a spot. You knew this was a spot. And we just, you know, Mary Kay, we were the only ones 60. The rest of them were well under 30. And the tears were just flowing down for what we had done to the Vietnamese people, what we had done to the young men of our time, the experience that we had. It was just an ache that has been there, I think, since I was probably in high school. But what we did see was Vietnam is healthy. Vietnam is, the people are ever resilient. They are right there. They were gracious. They were hospitable. They do need the American tourist money. It's very true. It's very important to their economy right now. But they were living their lives fully. It's not a very Buddhist country in the part we were in. It was still quite in Saigon and Ho Chi Minh City. It felt very Catholic still. But it was very, it was a big city. It felt like going to any big city. We went to the market and of course with all this, you know, kind of this emotion rising up inside of it, there was also great humor. So here Mary Kay and I, and this other friend of Mary Kay's, we go out to go to the farmer's market, the flea market. Now, you know, none of us happen to be so trim anymore. And we get on the motorcycles because that's the most common taxi. And the Vietnamese men are quite slim and quite fit. So the three 60-year-olds get off the back of the motorcycles. So we're on the back, you know, we're kind of holding up. We're kind of like looking at each other like we're on an adventure. And they're riding around those circles just like in the cartoons. Just like in the cartoons. And at one time, there was a bus, and I am not exaggerating. The bus was right here. And I went, woo-hoo! And I hear Mary Kay say, oh, my! And we just kept going around in these circles. And we thought, this is such an amazing experience. Just being in the middle of Saigon and in these thousands of motorcycles. And then we had to cross the street one time. It was just kind of this just amazing experience. So out of this intense emotion of one day of young experience and so much loss of life on both sides and lack of understanding and all that intense emotion, and then we were all just laughing, just great joy together. And when I had gotten my passport, my head was bald. And so when we were entering Vietnam, I'm flipping back for a moment. So that was another intense reaction. So we go up to go into immigration, and there he is in the North Vietnamese colors, the immigration officer. And he was a young man, and I was kind of like, I felt it. You know, I viscerally felt it. I just kind of got a little stiff going, what's he going to say? It's an American, and we're coming to Vietnam. How's it going to be? So he takes my passport, and he's kind of looking at it a long time, and I'm like, uh-oh, what's he going to say to me? And he looks up because he sees my bald head, which is no longer bald, and he said, sorry. He was sure it was chemo. No more, no less, just sorry. So I had this huge story going on because of some conditioning and some idea that I had. And so I was like, you know, shoulders got a little tight, got a little clammy. I mean, what am I going to do? A 60-year-old woman, I was hardly a threat. But I had that reaction, and he turned around with this very, very, and he was 22, 23 years oldish, very lovely. So I had another way to experience that kind of meeting, that kind of way of meeting my past, my stories, and the karma of my generation. To be able to step in, find this wonderful ethnic store, find the purse of the Mong Do, the people from Hue and all the way into Thailand, the tribal crowds. I have lots of attachment to this purse now. I have lots of attachment to this. I was so moved to find it. And then we went to Cambodia. And Cambodia was still pretty hard. It was pretty hard to see Cambodia. There's still lots of remnants. And we went to Siem Reap and lots of remnants of the war still. You really felt that. And we stayed in this, I mean, this hotel was like the Buddha's palace. It was so beautiful. It was just an unbelievable. Normally, we stay in kind of the $40 a night places. And this was just pure luxury, five people to take care of every need. But you could feel the story of the Buddha in there. We were in this gorgeous place, beautiful furniture, exquisitely done. You walk outside, you go down two blocks, and you walk down five blocks, and you're in the central marketplace, and there are all the 40-year-old men as a result of the Khmer Rouge. No limbs, the burns all over their body, and they were primarily book peddlers. You know, working on that. It was almost beyond words to have these experiences that I had the opportunity to have it face to face. And then we went to Angkor Wat. And we went through all of Angkor Wat, which is, you know, not so much, but the main Angkor Wat. And we were walking in and the stonework, thousands of people had to do the stonework in Angkor Wat. And so I thought, oh, I'd really like to offer incense . And I saw these five nuns were by the statue of the Buddha. And so I went up, my little chubby, middle-aged little body going up and looking at these women that were just so devoted and just taking care of the statue of the Buddha in this one area, and I asked them if I could offer incense, and they were so moved that I actually understood a form, that I understood a universal form of how to hold the incense with my arms up and touch it to the middle of my forest and then offer it. And it was, again, and then we just bowed to each other. We brought both sides of ourselves together and bowed to each other. And smiles, just complete smiles. So for a moment, I felt I was completely mindful of how we are all interconnected, no matter where we are and how we are, if we just make that simple gesture of bringing both sides of ourselves together and honoring each other with full respect. And that is my effort. That is my intention, that I make sure, whether I do it in a gassho bow or I do it silently, that my commitment is just to bring both sides of myself together, honor it within myself, and honor it to the person that I see, and meet whatever comes in front of me. No more, no less. It. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'm happy to. Do you have a question and answer now, or how's the schedule? Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for us, our morning starts at, well, we're on interim schedule right now, but I was laughing. Our morning starts at 3:40. my husband and I get up at 3:40. We have to have a little awake time before we go to meditation. And four of the seven nights, the day doesn't end till 9:00. So I always think everybody would be happy to have 3 or 4 or 8 minutes extra in their daytime. I mean, my life is about minutes. You know, you listen to that wood knocking to announce things, and you know you've got 6 minutes. And then, you know, you've got 8 minutes or 4 minutes. And so when you said, it says it's 8:49, I'm like, well, you got 11 minutes. it's just how it goes. But I am happy to answer any questions that you might have about Green Gulch or about what it's like to live in community, or I don't know how I did it for this long. I came for 3 weeks and I've been there 17 years. Yes.
So I think the last time I was here, Gil mentioned that when we're sitting, that's one of the best places to be angry if we're angry, because we can't really do any harm. But I'm wondering.
Wow.
But I'm wondering about this karma. And what gets created even when you're sitting if you're angry. And I wonder if you could just speak
I think if you don't embrace the anger, you are not necessarily having a positive, you're not working with it. The whole idea, as I understand it, is to embrace that anger and just watch it arise and sit with it and hold it with great respect. Don't go off onto a story. What happens oftentimes is instead of being with the anger, we start talking about the story. We got that story so down about why we're angry and we're so busy in the story. We're not looking at the anger. We're only looking at the story. So I think that you have to really take it deeply and rest it on your heart with great respect. And actually keep saying to yourself, when you watch yourself going off into the story, just bring it back and just say anger. The story starts arising again, starts going off, and the mind does wonderful things, doesn't it? You know, if you think, oh, I'm doing really good, I'm not going off into this story, all of a sudden the story's going off this way. You know, it's just going to, well, okay, you don't like it to do this, I'm going to give it to you this way. You have to go back. Anger, hurt, pain. Just respect is, I think, is the most important word when you're dealing with anger. Just really having a lot of respect for it. Instead of the normal way that we learn is to say, just don't let it get you. Just don't let it get you. Just get over it. Just get over it. No. Bring it in. Come on in. You're going to stay, aren't you? Well, let's just stay and let's see what happens. You know? And all of a sudden you start watching the tendrils of the story just kind of start loosening. A little bit. It often can come back, sometimes for years, but... but the tendrils will... They will gently loosen up because all of a sudden something starts just something starts shifting. But there's no telling. There's no time frame on that. It's just that you have an intention to pay attention. You're welcome. Are we done? Thank you very much.